This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Whatever happens today, plan to conquer it with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. True North Convenience Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. Our brew is truly perfect for any time of the day. During October and November, enter for a chance to win free coffee for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or find the mobile app in your favorite app store. Offer valid 10/7 through 12/1. True Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Langwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you experience when you share God's love with others. I had a little bit of that this weekend with my sister, certainly shared God's love with me. I was on vacation this past week, so this has started me right back into work, and what a wonderful way to do it with a wonderful guest. But first of all, I'd like to begin a program, as we do each week, with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. A young man asked Jesus, "Master, how can one deal with the loss of possessions that are precious to you?" Jesus was silent for a while and then answered, "Precious. It is a word. What does it mean?" The young man looked down at the earth and then up to the sky and said, "I don't want to discuss this matter in front of so many people." Jesus nodded and said, "Speak, my son, for your heart is filled with both tears and anger." "That is true," the young man replied, "but may I speak with you privately?" When the crowd had dispersed, the young man approached Jesus and said, "I could not speak of my loss in front of so many people." Jesus responded, "That is understandable." The young man continued, "I lost both my wife and my child in a fire. Both were gifts to me from God. I wandered through life and searched for the meaning of what had happened. I found work on a caravan. When the merchandise was sold, I was paid handsomely. I was going to return home and build a new life when I was robbed, beaten, and left to die." There was sadness and anger in his voice. Jesus urged him to continue. "Go on," he said. The young man said, "A rich man came by and saw me lying by the road. He looked down at me and threw me a coin, but he chose not to help me. I cried. I felt so alone. When he awoke, a beggar was holding me in his arms like a child. He was a leper, and I became frightened. He told me not to be afraid, that he would care for me, and he did. When I was well, I thanked him. But, Master, there was disgust and fear in me. I could tell in his eyes that he knew this, but he never said anything hateful to me. Now I have to live with this. I've never been able to find him, even though I have searched for him. I believe I have lost a true friend. How can I deal with this, Master?" Like the young man had done, Jesus looked down at the earth, up at the sky, and then at a tree filled with fruit. He said to the young man, "Go in peace and love. Like this tree, you bear much fruit that allows you to care for and share with others." A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes in the introduction to his book titled Finding Comfort During Hard Times, subtitled A Guide to Healing After Disease, Violence, and Other Community Trauma. And he writes in the introduction, "Disasters do not discriminate between culture, race, class, or geography. This is not an issue affecting small pockets of unlucky people. The whole country has been touched by tragedy, Hurricane Sandy, the Boston Marathon bombing, the shootings at the churches and synagogues in North Carolina, Texas, and Pennsylvania, Sandy Hook Elementary School, Columbine, the Aurora Movie Theater. Since the beginning of this project, there has been the Paris and Las Vegas shootings, the hurricanes in Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico, California wildfires and mudslides, the Parkland school shooting, and the shooting in New Zealand. Through news and social media, it sometimes feels like we are exposed to one tragedy after another. The issue of how to respond to mass fatality disasters is, unfortunately, not going away. In every place touched by disaster, people are longing for hope and comfort, striving to find purpose and meaning. After Hurricane Katrina alone, there were 250,000 volunteers. People want to give and receive comfort from each other after these tragedies. But what exactly should they do? How should and could they respond? How do you talk to children about mass shootings or provide support to someone who has lost a loved one? How much can we endure? These are only a few of the questions that our guest this evening answers in his book, Finding Comfort for Hard Times. And I'm speaking of Earl Johnson, who was one of the founders of the Spiritual Care Function in the American Red Cross. He helped develop the organization's psychological first aid curriculum and coping with deployment. He also worked on Light Our Way for the National Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster. Earl Johnson, welcome to Amplify.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted and humbled to be with you this evening.
I love your book. It's very helpful, very practical from one perspective, and yet very personal and an expression of great wisdom in others that answers some of the questions just posed by these remarks that I spoke of from your introduction. Tell us a little bit about how you got swept up in a new career working as a spiritual care specialist for disaster situations.
Well, my background was in hospital chaplaincy and hospice chaplaincy, and I spent a lot of time in an AIDS ministry at Cabrini Medical Center in New York City, one of the epicenters of the AIDS epidemic. And it just, you know, was very, very rewarding, very, very difficult. I choose to accentuate the positive first because I, too, have been given many gifts, and working there at a Catholic medical center in New York City during the AIDS pandemic, I should not interchange the pandemic with the epidemic, but it really was a very vital ministry, and each day was very compelling to a new set of challenges. And then September 11th happened, and I had just moved on September 9th from Lower Manhattan to Arlington, Virginia, And I was sitting in my backyard, and I heard the plane hit the Pentagon. And I didn't realize that that's what it was, because living next to a hospital emergency room in New York City, you're used to explosions and loud sounds and truck backfires, et cetera. And my sister was also at end-stage cancer, and it became increasingly more difficult for me to walk into a hospital room and see a middle-aged woman with end-stage cancer, because I would always be thinking of my dear sister. And so I had an opportunity to go with a special team in Red Cross that was formed to respond to mass fatality disasters like plane crashes, and to be there because the families and loved ones and survivors requested help, because after these catastrophic incidents, there is always an outpouring of big-hearted, generous people, but also predators and entrepreneurs, and they wanted to be protected and they wanted to be served. And so I took the training with Red Cross, and I found that all my hospice and hospital training transferred right over to the disaster arena, and the same focus, the same skill sets. And so that's a little bit about how I changed from hospital chaplaincy to disaster chaplaincy.
Yeah, on a personal note, my mother had hospice care before she died a number of years ago, and I will never forget how they cared for her. I still tell the stories today as a sign of hope for people. Now, I have, in my introduction, expressed what I believe you have accomplished in this book. What is it that you hope to accomplish in writing it?
Well, that's a great question, and I've had a chance now in retirement from Red Cross to sort of use this time for reflection. And I'm out in the Shenandoahs, and I'm very privileged and very blessed. I have had this opportunity to reflect upon all this trauma, some that I've endured myself. Most of it has been endured by people in these mass fatality disasters, whether it's been a plane crash or a hurricane. And this emerging need for comfort, I thought, oh my gosh, maybe I'm not the only one that in their reflections that we have this profound need for comfort. So many people are in pain. So many people are in suffering, just in normal everyday life, with everyday traumas, not to mention a catastrophic weather event or shooting. And so what I hope to accomplish is to have a handy guide that people can come to for suggestions. If it's relevant, great, use it, pass it on. If it's not, then, you know, I hope that some point of this book will resonate with all readers.
And I think it will, again, because we live in a time when, indeed, you refer to the weather, there are fires once again in California, and the shootings that have taken place in some of our major cities. And we could go on and on just talking about the United States. And let me just give an example of at the end of each chapter, you offer ways to help people for preparing a disaster. First one is a way to comfort. I'm not going to read each of the citations fully, but take disaster training. Even a basic course makes a difference. Take a deep breath and make a plan. Evaluate your basic needs and resources and build a disaster kit. Talk to family, friends, colleagues, children. Make sure they know what to do. Don't let the stress of getting things perfect prevent you from doing anything at all. Be flexible. Be confident. Designate a family member, friend to contact in emergency. Be patient. Be kind. Be authentic. And again, you write much more than that, but just to give an idea of what they can find at the end of each chapter. You believe that Noah's Ark was the first disaster emergency response vehicle. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. There's a real disaster culture, and they seek to, whether on the negative side, whether you have ambulance chasers, or whether on the positive side, you know, specially trained emergency response people. And I hearkened back to the Old Testament and the flood as being sort of the first real weather emergency with the flood and the rain, and an emergency response vehicle is what we in yes. Red Cross call our trucks, our canteens that we send out, whether it's a house fire or whether it's a tornado or shooting, to serve coffee and sandwiches, but also to help assess the situation and get people out there helping as quickly as they can. So that was my icebreaker.
Yes, I'm sure it was. And you point out that disasters are a major part of human and natural history, and not just natural disasters. And today the scale and scope of disaster seems to have increased. It's sort of always been there, that fear, that anxiety. I graduated from grade school in 1954. So I remember back in the 1950s when we had school drills, when we would have to go when they were afraid of war, of bombing, and we would go to the basement of the school in front of a locker, and we were told how we were to stand with our face towards the locker and our hands over our head. And so all the way back then, I remember those stories. And September 11th has had such an effect on disaster preparedness. And the book shows us that there have been a number of lessons that we can learn from that disaster, from each of them. And you believe that everyone needs to have a disaster plan. And about a decade ago, I was in a program with Citizens Academy for the FBI, and I attended one day a week, 6 weeks or 7 weeks for a while. And we did a tabletop exercise to show how we need to be prepared, how people are prepared who have such a plan. Should the church be included in a disaster plan, because it seems to be a soft target?
Oh my God, yes, of course. And knowledge lessens anxiety. Knowing what to do, knowing who's going to do what, does lessen the anxiety, and it makes us have the feeling that, you know, we don't have to do everything, and that there are those that are who are specially trained to help us. And in the church, because it is a community, it is a soft target, and you know, risk assessment. For years, local congregations or synagogues or mosques now have had disaster preparedness drills, and they've also had security officers assigned to them, some after the fact, because you can't imagine something like that happening to you, something happening here. To prepare for this, I say, is caring. To prepare is to care. And if you truly love one another, which goes back to our gospel underpinning, then to love one another is to take care of one another, to prepare for whatever eventuality, both good times and bad times, take preparation. And churches certainly need a disaster plan. And it's not a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you have a plan, then you're going to make the disaster happen. And there's also with a certain segment of the population, the belief that God is going to swoop down at the last minute and rescue everyone if the congregation is in danger. And I think that theology is flawed, but I respect those who believe that the Lord will protect us. Mm-hmm. But we have to do our part. You know, we have to put on our oxygen mask first before we put it on the child. And so congregations, we are pillars of the community. Even now during this COVID pandemic, this horrible, horrible pandemic, we still are neighbors. And
Earl,
to be
Earl,
a good neighbor.
Earl, let me. Yeah. We have to go to our first break. Hold your thought and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Amplify. Our guest is Errol Johnson. The title of the book is Finding Comfort During Hard Times. These are hard times. There are many disasters that we could point out. And through the book, he guides you, is a subtitle, to healing after disease and violence and other kinds of trauma. And when we broke off one hand to break in, Errol, you were talking about the present pandemic.
Yes, yes. And it is an extraordinary event. This is a really, really hard time, and I think that needs to be emphasized to your listeners and to know that this is not normal, and that we need to take extra care with each other. And I look at how many people are unemployed or underemployed. I look at the increase in violence, shootings in our urban settings. You know, people don't have jobs. There's food scarcity. And on top of that, there is a acute illness that there isn't a vaccine for. So it's a very, very hard time, and it calls us to be good neighbors and also follow the CDC guidelines.
The book itself, you prepare us for disaster where comfort begins, and then there are a myriad number of ways in which we can comfort people at various stages. The contents include the first day, the first week, the first month, the first year and beyond, then natural disasters, managing comfort, everyday traumas, families and comfort, and the future of comfort. And when you're writing about the first day, you indicate that when tragedy occurs, you remember where you were and what you were doing. I have such memories of Vietnam when I went to families to tell wives and mother and father of someone killed in Vietnam. I can remember a suicide in a hospital, many others. But you write about, ideally, everyone should be told about a tragedy in a controlled and private situation by a trained professional. But it doesn't always work that way because sometimes you witness it. Instant communication can be reassuring, but it can also be traumatizing. Part of the spiritual care you write at this time is simply, and this is the first day, is simply helping people to breathe and focus on now, not tomorrow's worries, that anxiety can especially be intense when victims include children, and caring for yourself is also important. What else should we be expecting the first day or amplify on any one of these points?
Well, the root of spirit is respire, which means to breathe in Latin, and spiritual care, in other words, may be helping people breathe. And, you know, wherever we are, when we hear about something bad, we catch our breath, and it's useful to remind people, take a deep breath. Okay, now what is it that we need to do? Or Are you someone who is so close to the disaster that you need to be taken care of? And, you know, no one is untouched by these traumatic events. We're all impacted by them, and trauma does accumulate.
And chapter 3 is the first week, and you write about what we can do to help those left behind, that the most moving part of a memorial service is a moment of silence. And we should understand that the site where that happened may not be religious, but if it's where your loved one died, then we might believe it to be sacred. And one of the examples you give is a Pittsburgh airline crash in 1994 when 132 persons were killed, and that was a relative of one of the people that I work with. Tell us a little bit about the first week then. What's important? Why it can be important to stay in the bubble and not watch any outside news or coverage?
Well, you're in shock, and I really emphasize the self-care piece, because if you're working in this environment and taking care of extremely traumatized people who've just lost a loved one in just an unimaginable way, it takes a special skill set, and sometimes a trained mental health professional or doctor, because there may be some need for medicine or something to help someone sleep or calm down, and there is no peace. And so that first week, you're beginning to meet each day. And you still need to be respected. Your dignity needs to be maintained, and you need to have people around you that you trust. But sometimes, you know, being a first responder, as you mentioned it, sometimes the disaster comes to you, like the Minneapolis Interstate Bridge collapse. Those people, you know, who almost went off the bridge, became first responders to pulling people and children off of a school bus until fire and EMS could arrive. And the sort of spontaneous, unaffiliated volunteer. And there's a role for everybody, but there's also a role to leave, and knowing when to leave, knowing when to pass the baton to another care provider.
I like in your ways to comfort the first week, and again, there are 10 of them. A couple of them that stood out to me. Say something, send a card. You don't have to find the perfect words. Silence hurts more. Let loved ones know you are thinking about them. Be a listening ear. Connect with others. And so there are a lot of ways at every stage in which we can provide comfort, aren't there?
Absolutely. And you know, this is after the press leaves, or after the family leaves, after the funeral, or some kind of ritual. Now with COVID, we can't actually have funerals yet. And so it's, you know, there's a time that you are called to just be with someone, and you don't have to say a lot. And then as days go by, then there's a time of saying, you know, if you need to talk, I'm here. Any day, any time, I am here for you. And also make sure you know that that person is safe with you, that you... everyone has the opportunity to share through some kind of ritual in the church. Mm-hmm. But, you know, each person, there's something called common sense, and that doesn't, you know, that's not thrown out the window just because there's a disaster, but being with people, saying something, making sure they know they're safe with you, because these people are in such extraordinary pain. They have been traumatized. They are suffering, and they may need you to be there with them and take care of them.
You point out in the first month, now after the first month of a disaster, that your identity often changes, that there is a new normal, and people are already beginning to talk about that now in terms of the pandemic. What is the new normal going to be? And in every disaster, you indicate that there are phases, and that each phase is unique to every disaster. And you write about ways to comfort during the first month. But tell us a little bit about what is hospitality? What do you mean by hospitality fatigue and the concept of the second disaster?
Well, after Hurricane Katrina, there were over 2 million, I believe, evacuees from New Orleans and the Gulf Coast that needed services, and there were flights, continuous flights out of New Orleans and out of the Gulf Coast, and people were called upon to be hosting families all over the nation in all 50 states, and there was a sort of honeymoon phase where people, you know, I'd receive calls in Washington, D.C. It's like, you know, we have a summer camp that we've been able to reopen, you know, and it was September and the weather was still not too cold. And people say, where are our evacuees? And then, you know, people would be cheerful, people would greet, people would welcome, people would comfort, people would console. And then after a week or 2 weeks, when are they going to leave? The hospitality was strained, and you know, people are saying, okay, we need to get on with our lives, this being a host, it there were limits, there were boundaries to the amount of hospitality individuals or communities could offer.
And tell us a little bit about the symptoms of what you refer to as spiritual stress, the feeling, people feeling the need to be punished.
Well, without getting into theology, I spent a lot of time in the psychiatric ward at Cabrini, and there was, you know, people that had severe mental issues, emotional issues, and there was a feeling, you know, I'm not good enough, or I'm not loved, and the need, to either inflict pain upon themselves or others, but just this whole feeling that I deserve this disaster, I deserve this house fire because I'm a bad person, or, you know, I'm responsible for this tornado, or I'm responsible for this plane crash. And of course, we know that is extremely harmful thinking and not true. So, you know, it's a flawed theology, but I respect it. I understand it because we still have a goodly number of folks, even some of your listeners, who might believe that illness was divine punishment.
Yes.
But I have a more benevolent and hospitable image of God in my mind, a God of love and not of rage.
Do we need to be attentive in any way to the basic needs of the first responders?
Oh, we sure do, because they are talk about accumulated trauma. Each day is another trauma for them, and they have to have on-the-job training that helps them know what to do, know their part of it. But as a first responder, a policeman, a fireman, an emergency EMT, it just... you know, we need to be gentle with our public servants, and it's very heartening to see after disasters that oftentimes people bring food to the firehouse or to the police station. Just these gestures of hospitality and of caring for our professionals, because, you know, we only see the headlines of the bad ones, and they're traumatic too. But you know, we really, really need to take care of our public servants, because that's an extraordinary vocation, helping other people.
You also point out that it's helpful to create a new physical space to remember what was lost, and some of the ways of comfort in the first month. I can't read them completely. Ask questions about one's life before and after the disaster. It's a comfort to tell one's story, but only when one is ready to tell it. Survivors may be recovering and depressed, know when to refer to a professional. Comfort takes patience and inspiration. Caring isn't a competition. Kindness starts with an expanded heart. Make a will or help a loved one make a will. Grief is irrational. Comfort is dedicated. Loss accumulates. So it's written with deep faith, great wisdom, and sensitivity and love. And in fact, when we begin to talk about the first year and beyond, 9/11 is, you point out, is still too raw, even for you.
It is, and as I say, I moved from Lower Manhattan to Arlington, Virginia, and that I can't go to the museum in Southern Manhattan, because as I say, it's very valuable, because the story, the history needs to be preserved and shared. But there's a part of it of not re-traumatizing someone. I very studiously avoid videos of September 11th, and also the death of George Floyd was incredibly traumatizing, I was several thousand miles away, but if you have a heart and soul and a person of compassion, we all were affected by this, and we're still seeing the consequences of that day.
And you write, to a spouse or parent, their loved one is still very much here. There may still be many complex emotions a year later in dealing with such a profound loss. Give people permission to share and to be a good listener. There can be a comfort in being unafraid to have a conversation about the deceased. It even can be considered healthy and normal. Do not discount the importance of being there and comforting. During these anniversaries, remember, feelings are not only enhanced, but hiding behind a made-up face and a well-brushed hairdo. And some of that other things you write about during the first year and beyond are that it's a time when many uncomfortable decisions have to be made, that fatalities were once described in numbers, and today it is widely understood that fatalities should be represented by their names. Real names ensure that they are remembered. And not only do we need to know how to comfort, but also where we will need to be comforted. And you believe that in the future, there's going to be greater need for comforters. And rather than ask you another question that I have to break in less than a minute now, you recommend spiritual care providers who know how to comfort those who have been traumatized by catastrophic events. And so, again, so sensitively, and you write that ways to comfort the first year, help assemble a visual document of the disaster event, attend a memorial on the first anniversary, visit the cemetery with the family, help plan and implement an anniversary ritual for those who still may be none, help with financial needs. Is it time yet to replace a treasured pet? Go for a walk with a survivor. Plant a tree. Help a child remember and be prepared to answer questions. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Once upon a mundane morning, Barb's day got busy without warning. A realtor in need of an open house sign? No, 50 of them. And designed before 9.
My head hurts.
Any mighty tools to help with this plight?
Aha!
Barb made her move. She opened Canva and got in the groove.
Bulk creating Canva sheets. Create 50 signs fit for suburban streets.
Done in a click, all complete.
Sweet!
Now, imagine what your dreams can become when you put imagination to work at Canva.com.
Did you know your credit card points and miles can lose value to inflation? Credit card companies often reduce the redemption value of your points and miles. Now, imagine a credit card with rewards that can grow in value. With the Gemini credit card, you can earn Bitcoin or one of over 50 other cryptos instantly with no annual fee. Every swipe at the store or gas pump earns you instant rewards deposited straight to your account. Plus, sign up now for a $200 Bitcoin bonus to kickstart your rewards. Visit Gemini.com/card today. Check out the link in the description for more information on rates and fees. Again, if you're looking to invest in Bitcoin but don't know where to start, the Gemini credit card makes it easy.
The Gemini credit card is issued by WebBank. In order to qualify for the $200 crypto intro bonus, you must spend $3,000 in your first 90 days. Terms apply. Some exclusions apply to instant rewards in which rewards are deposited when the transaction posts. This content is not investment advice, and trading crypto involves risk. For more details on rates, fees, and other cost information, see rates and fees. The Gemini credit card may not be used to make gambling-related purchases.